Hello, and welcome to the Regrettable Century. I'm Chris, and today we are continuing with part two of our discussion on Dialectic of Defeat, Contours of Western Marxism by Russell Jacoby, which we are doing in collaboration with our good friend Adam from Red Library. So this is part two. If you haven't listened to part one yet, go back and listen to that first. Enjoy the show.
Well, I guess in terms of sort of moving on from here, I know that Jacoby really tries to trace this sort of like orthodox Marxist strain and this unorthodox Marxist strain through different schools of Marxism in Russia and the Italian and French Hegelians. I know that we're sort of really kind of cleaving to a lot of the like core ideas. I know he has some stuff about the German Revolution in here in Luxembourg. Where do y'all want to go just with whatever time we have to talk through all this stuff?
Well, I think that it's worth talking about the Italian Hegelians because we have to deal with the fact that the Italian Hegelians, the historical Hegelians anyway, are the nucleus of the core that becomes the fascist movement.
Oh, you know? Yeah, that sounds kind of relevant, sure.
Right. Fascism can be described as a Hegelian political philosophy in that it, like, its key driving thought is the dialectical combination of opposites, right? The synthesis of a class system or of a state system that unifies the opposing classes of proletarian and bourgeoisie and comes up with a synthesis of those that ends up being the strongest possible way to organize the state, according to the fascists anyway, right? From the Italian Hegelians, Jacoby talks a lot about, Labriola's correspondence with Sorel, Georges Sorel, yeah. Right? And he talks a lot about the correspondence between these two people. And Sorelianism is sort of the offshoot of Marxism, the sort of deviation of Marxism that is at the core of fascism. And I think it's worth noting that the people that I think got it right on scientific versus historical Hegelianism take it in a direction and just overemphasize the idealism. And it's not an inevitable thing, right? Fascism doesn't just come inevitably from an over-idealistic reading of Marxism. You know, there are some other factors involved in there.
For example, we are not fascists.
Right, we are not fascists, exactly. I mean, there's a whole nationalism thing that I don't think is, you know, that is in Sorelianism at all, but that is absolutely in the Italian syndicalism that turns into fascism.
And I think just to plug this in here too, and this is definitely talked about in the book, it's sort of impossible to understand these particular philosophical and theoretical developments without also understanding the failure of the German Revolution of, you know, 1918 through mm-hmm. 1923 and seeing this particular way to weaponize Hegelian historical, you know, subjectivity around the nation state was also like absolutely seen as a response to that failure as well, I think.
Right.
I don't know how much that adds to the conversation. I just wanted to put it in there.
Well, I think that you have to take a set of ideas and and the trajectory that they really did take, and situate that in their sort of, you know, material conditions to have the best possible sort of understanding of the relationship between ideas and conditions. And one thing that I think you can look at Sorel and his ideas and his writings is, you know, he was heralded by the Italian fascists as the, you know, the progenitor of their ideas. But he didn't say that. And there were Marxists and there were anarchists and there were socialists who regarded Sorrell's ideas very well as well. I think you have to look at the rise of fascism coming out of the failure of a workers' revolution and the assertion of what class interests are being asserted there. And I think that that is an ambiguity that can be found in Sorrell is you know, he criticizes capitalism and he calls for and he defends violence and calls for revolution and all these and appeals to the motivating necessity of myth behind what inspires people to assert themselves and alter their conditions. And but that can be taken in a lot of different ways. And I think that what he doesn't articulate is which class is going to be the class that that has to be the motor force for destroying capitalism, replacing it with something else. It's and that it leaves the interpretation open to whether it should be the working class or a petty bourgeoisie.
Well, yeah, the experience of fascism really ought to have put to rest forever the what we call sort of economic determinism, the sort of the historical guarantee that the development of the productive forces leads inevitably to, you know, the rise in class conflict and which whatever and so on, right? Like, you know, if consciousness is located, the development of consciousness is located in the living processes of society, that doesn't necessarily mean that kind of like that resolves in any particular way. In fact, what we have seen is that, you know, the inability to kind of make that that leap, you know, that free action, that's where fascism comes from. Is yes, all of those things, all of those clashes, and the sort of breakdown of the European social order might have been determined by the course of capital itself. But the conclusion of or the resolution of the contradictions at that moment are anything but guaranteed.
Well, really quick, I just wanted to throw this in here. You know, it strikes me that the fact that we even had to preface all of this by saying, listen, everybody, we're definitely not fascists. Like, I think it does speak to the importance of Jacoby's approach here, which is to say, whenever we look back on this, you know, what we're sort of responding to by even having to say that is that we understand very clearly, or there's some part of us that knows that if whenever we look back on history and to this like absolutely nightmarish, tragic consequence of these developments, that it is going to, it's going to more often than not, you're going to take sort of historical material circumstances and then conclude that, well, whichever one won out or however these things developed actually speaks to the truth of a particular ideological or theoretical development. And right. So part of why we even have to say that is because we know very well that people are going to look back on that history and say, well, if someone is saying this thing that, you know, is highly complex and very nuanced as a theoretical argument, because I know this has some sort of vague connection to this past historical development that led to fascism, they also must be fascists. Right. And I think that's part of what we're sort of trying to push on here, is to say that you can't necessarily equate, you know, capital T truth with success and with like what eventually won out, which maybe was about, you know, structural forces, was about power. And you know, it sort of relies on, more often than not, I think, a pretty vague and weak history of even understanding, like, what the hell was it that happened? Like, why did it play out that way?
Right. So one of the things that led to the formation of fascism was this idea that the productive forces of capitalism needed to be built up in mm-hmm. order for socialism to happen. And that, of course, exists in, you know, all of Marxism. But the revolutionary syndicalists, or the national syndicalists, as they turned out to be in Italy, had the idea that you could install a sort of state capitalism and have a collaboration between the classes that sort of mitigated the worst excesses of capitalism in order to bring forth the industrialization that needed to exist in order to have socialism. And, you know, the fascists just said, well, you know, why don't we just have that sort of synthesis and not ever have the need for socialism? We could just have classes and cooperation forever. But it started off with that sort of very core Marxist idea that the productive forces of capitalism were necessary for the growth of, I mean, for the existence of socialism. So yeah, if you're going to call us fascists for siding with the historical Hegelians, you got to call all the Marxists fascists, right? And some will.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Glenn Beck will.
Yeah, that's true.
Comrade Glenn Beck, the true upholder of revolutionary thought.
He's the only one who really understood Hoxha.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, was there anything else about the rise of fascism, that particular period, the Italian Marxists, you wanted to hit on? Because, yeah, I agree.
Kind of wanted to touch on it. Yeah. I thought it was interesting. And I've also heard it. I've heard it mentioned in passing, like, oh, yeah, well, the Hegelian Marxists are what the people that turned into the fascists, you know, as kind of like a way to dismiss, you know, historical Hegelianism.
Well, maybe on this note, I think we should probably give a little bit of a shout out to, I guess, the left comms and Gorder and Panikek and the Dutch Marxists, because I think that's it's sort of a similar argument that gets made there, too, that, you know, dismissing sort of this particular school or this particular group, along with these historical Hegelians, these unorthodox Marxists, Western Marxists, as being just, you know, inherently also like plagued with these sort of weaknesses, or somehow they lost, and so their whole way of thinking about Marxism and subjectivity is also, you know, confined to the dustbin of history as well.
Yeah, I mean, but really we all lost, like Trotskyism lost, Stalinism lost, Maoism lost, like, other than whoever's upholding, you know, Xi Jinping thought, everybody has lost.
Yeah, I mean, capital is the only winner as far as I can see.
So far, yeah.
One of the things that kept coming back to me, a thought that I kept having when reading this book, is that I find myself sympathizing with a lot of the different groups or people that that were mentioned, and how I would not have been allowed to 10 years ago.
Oh, goodness, no.
No. And, you know, I mean, I sympathize with the left comms here, even though I ultimately disagree with them. And I think, okay, well, there are bits and pieces I can take from here. You know, I sympathize with the Frankfurt School, even though I ultimately disagree with what the Frankfurt School turned into. And I mean, and I just thought about how this sort of microsect mentality that we had, we had our own orthodoxy that we stuck to, that was very much part of the orthodox Marxism that the Jacobi is against here. And I find myself thinking, wow, I'm really glad that I now have the freedom to pick and choose from the thoughts of all of these great Marxists in order to try to figure out what it is that we need to do to move forward. And I'm not constrained by a religious orthodoxy.
Yeah, well, a freedom to explore ideas, right? Without having to read it with an eye toward why are they wrong? You know, what did they do wrong? How can I prove that Lenin was right and the ultra lefts were wrong? You're just free to explore ideas and weigh them against your own experience in life, and see where that gets you, and hopefully come out a more well-rounded Marxist on the other side.
Right. So, sorry. In the spirit of that, I think I would want to, and this might be too much of a digression, but I would want to contrast that sort of monolithism to an eclecticism. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessary. I mean, let's say, speaking personally, I don't know if the goal is necessarily to just take everything, you know, from what's good in Mao, you know, and what's good in Gorder, and blend it all together and be like, okay, here's the new 21st century communism. But I think the point is to try to achieve something of a sort of a complex rather than arithmetical sum of all these parts, right?
Right.
Like, at what point can we arrive, not just by like stacking things on top of each other, but by clashing them together and seeing what is the synthesis of these various propositions? What new might we be able to fashion out of an approach which reopens the door, to the monolith, to try to attain some heterodoxy? It's not necessarily the same thing, literally every single idea and approach and tactic and strategy and philosophy is fine, right? But everything is worth contending with, mm-hmm. openly and honestly.
Yeah, I actually think too that for me, this whole discussion in the book about left communism is really, I think to me, I would almost describe it as like a really sort of generative, like productive thing to encounter, because I guess like his way of describing it is that the real sort of division or the real struggle between, let's say, like Lenin, Soviet Marxism and left communism was about like theoretical differences, but it was also about like context. It was about historical material context in which they were developing, and how for a lot of the Dutch Marxists, I mean, he has this great line where he basically says that, you know, for the Dutch, they were dealing with the oldest, longest running civil society set of institutions anywhere in Europe. And they were very clear that, listen, if we're going to be able to develop some sort of revolutionary movement here, we have to understand the context. And you need to understand that the Russian context is not our context. And that's what I found really interesting, is really shaping this not about like who had the better theory and that's what we take from it, but to say this was really a struggle about what was contextually and materially appropriate to the circumstances. And I think this idea of like an eclectic sort of Marxism, to me, being a good Marxist has always been engaging with these things in a really sort of good faith, kind of like productive way, precisely to say, okay, what does this help me understand about my context now and the material conditions that I'm in now? And I think whenever you look at it that way, it's not about necessarily saying who was right and who was wrong, but saying, you know, which one functions most dialectically for where we are now? And like, how do I understand like the role of mass media and surveillance and organizing some sort of revolutionary movement? Like, who's going to help me understand that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It struck me as, you know, I guess I never really considered this because I never engaged with the Dutch Marxists before. I was always discouraged from doing that. But it struck me that the idea that there might be an entirely different set of circumstances in which the Dutch needed to engage the bourgeoisie in contention for power than existed in Russia, and that that would be controversial, that just blew my mind.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that the idea that the Dutch Marxists would be against would be set up against the Comintern, yeah, in an argument about what was good for their country. You know, we always hear about the heroic Comintern, and a lot less is said about the pig-headed and stupid Comintern. Both existed, mm-hmm, right? And you know, I think it's worth talking about both of them on their own terms.
Well, I have this picture in my mind of the Sudden Clarity Clarence meme, where it's like him having like the, you know, the huge insight, and it's just that context matters. Like, that's what I see, because yeah, I think that is the case. I mean, I don't know about y'all, but I have this argument with Marxists today about, I always use State and Revolution as an example. It's like, right, we're gonna read State and Revolution, cool, we should do this, and it's like, y'all, like, you realize that was like 100 years ago in like a vastly like peasant dominated society and so on and so forth. And it's almost like, oh shit, like, oh, that's a thing that we have to think about? Well, never mind. We're just going to still do what Lenin says.
Yeah. Look, even Russia isn't like Russia was then. And the United States today is more like Russia. No, so I'm getting it all mixed up. Russia today isn't like Russia was then. And the United States then was more like Russia today than it is. Like, basically, that was never an appropriate conversation for the United States, to try to like do what the Russians did, unless you're talking about in the broadest possible sense of a head first confrontation with the powers of capital and its state. In that sense, yeah, there's a conversation to be had, but the form of that should be necessarily different because we live in a different place.
There was always the statistic thrown out there that the working class of South Korea in the late 90s was bigger than the working class of the entire world in 1917.
Mm. Wait, is that right?
I don't know. Maybe it was the working class of Russia in 19. No, it was the entire world. The working class of South Korea in the late 90s is bigger than the working class of the entire world.
That sounds
world
plausible to me, at least. At the very least.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds true.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't have to include that in there. That was just something that people always used to say in the ISO.
I think that it's, even if it's not literally true, it's relatively true. It approximates a truth that is worth thinking about.
That was a philosophical shit right there. That was great.
This is why we're the farcical repetition table.
Well said.
Well, so I think that going back to the point that I forget who said it. Somebody mentioned that there's a real eclecticism in a lot of the left Marxists the left communists that Jacoby discusses throughout these chapters. And it's hard to sit and take one as right or wrong, or to even. And I might even go a step further and say, they may have all been entirely wrong in all instances. That may still be the case, and it can still also be true that a lesson that sort of resounds by the time you get to the end of this book, The Dialectic of Defeat, is that at every turn, any figures who were proven, you know, leaders in their resident sort of home communist parties in the Western European countries were put down, by force of assertion of authority of the central leaders of the Comintern were told, no, you're not allowed to disagree with us. You're removed from your position of authority, and anybody subsequent to you who attempts to make an argument that sounds similar to the one that you're currently making will also be removed and chastised and castigated and run out of the party. Like, that is the thing that is the lesson I think that has to be taken, is that whatever chance global communism ever had of winning against capitalism, it necessitated the capacity or the freedom to explore other ideas and weigh them on their merits rather than by the sheer force of who is the winner, who holds the power, who holds the Iron Throne, as it were. And I think his quoting of Luxembourg's formulation that flips, you know, Marx's formulation on its head is absolutely crucial. It's the key to all of it, which is that she said, men do not make history just as they please, but they do make their own history. That history didn't have to be the way that it turned out, that the Comintern didn't, she was making had a slightly different target at the moment that she said that. But in hindsight, looking at this book and looking at the choices that the Comintern made, that it didn't have to have turned out the way it did. That there were choices that individuals made along the way. And we should take great heed.
Right. And maybe even a little bit of comfort, such as I'm going to allow myself to do in anything, right? Because it means that we're not just on the tracks of history in a passenger car, being directed somewhere by forces beyond our control. That actually choices that people make as individuals and as groups influence the direction of the... Well, I guess the train. So the metaphor falls apart now, but the point is, it's not a train, right? It's more like a car. It can go any direction.
I think on that note, too, it reminds me of a point I had at the very beginning of my notes, which is Jacoby's critique of this ideology of success that has sort of kind of spiderwebbed its way through our understanding of Marxism and history is that, you know, Marxism itself wasn't immune to being commodified and to being able to, you know, be consumed and utilized and alienated from the same way we're alienated and consume commodities now. And, you know, part of what I wonder is, you know, this way that we sort of pick up and we say, oh, okay, I'm going to be a Maoist. Okay, I'm going to be, you know, a Marxist-Leninist, is succumbing to this kind of commodified version of Marxism that's sort of like the negative eclectic that, you know, it's the kind that we don't want. We don't want to see like these various Marxisms as just I pick up one and identify with it and make my identity based on that. You know, what we're looking for is a way to like dialectically relate them to each other and learn from them, precisely because, you know, the everything around us also wants us to believe, yes, you know, we are on this train and these tracks are set and, you know, there's no way to stop climate change. There's no way to change the institutions of power. And when I think a lot of Marxists like believe that too, you know, it's these basic fundamental assumptions that, you know, we all have really bought hook, line, and sinker. And I think that Western Marxism is probably our best tool to figure out how to critique those in ourselves and in the movements and groups we're a part of too.
Yeah,
that's it. That's all I got. That's all I have to say about that. Well, really quick, I know we've been talking for a while, and I want to respect y'all's time. How much time do y'all have, by the way?
I'm good. I can keep.
Yeah,
going.
I'm good to keep going and finish. I could stick it out, and we could finish the book if y'all are up for it. Yeah.
I mean, I could do this for like 7 hours on end. I just want to make sure that if y'all got shit to do, you know, you get a chance to do that.
Yeah, my wife's out of town, so I'm a bachelor. The only thing I'm going to do is go read a different book whenever I get done with this.
At some point I have to refer back to my notes. I'm reading Capital Volume 2, and it's the hardest one to read, and I have to go to a discussion about it.
I feel
tonight.
For you.
I feel like it's worthwhile. I'm thinking about it kind of like, you know, the way that I've never been to the gym, but people say that when you know, you don't see results for a while, you know, so you're just gonna have to power through it.
It's that you're getting out of that like immediate gratification that we've all been socialized to want under capital, you know?
Yeah, I'm trying to take a cue from my new favorite proto-fascist, Otto Spengler.
And Oswald.
What's that?
Oswald Spengler, not Otto.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't think that name could be more German, but I'm pretty sure Otto Spengler is the most German name I've ever heard
of. What if you say Oswald?
Yeah,
it sounds even more German.
I suppose that's true. If you say it like all German sounding, it is more German.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know where this fits in, so it seems like maybe right after making some dumb jokes is the best place to do it. But
that's how we roll on Red Library, so I mean I think you're good.
That's also
I think
how
we're more or less in chapter 4.
Yes, that's where I'm at too, yeah.
So my very first note for chapter 4 is I wrote, this is it's a quotation, a Lukács quotation, says that politics is merely the means and that culture is the goal. And then he kind of goes on to talk about how like social being determines consciousness, but the revolutionary transformation of society and the changing of all the social conditions is meant to reverse this. You know, that revolution is, if anything, is a leap out of the grip of reification. Mm. And it got me thinking about what seems, in retrospect, to be quite a prescient sort of vague musing of Kevin's from, like, 2009. We were sitting in my living room when we were college students, and he said, and I forget the exact context, but he said something to the effect of, like, well, look, if all of history, if the engine of history is the class struggle, and if, you know, that dialectic, that discovery of that dialectic is Marx turning Hegel on his head, and if communism is the riddle of history solved, right, which is the sort of the abolition of the social basis of class antagonisms and thus of class struggle and thus the stepping out of that engine of history, doesn't that mean that the arrival of, you know, at the communist horizon is the moment in which Hegel's dialectic gets turned back on its feet and that it's actually the clash of ideas which becomes the new motor force of history? And at the time I was like, damn, that's like, you know, some interesting something, and I kind of moved on or whatever. I didn't realize at the time that Kevin was a proto Lukácsian Hegelian Marxist.
Do you remember saying that, Kevin?
Yeah, I remember that. I do, actually. Yeah, I was like half drunk at a house party that we were raising money for to go to the conference or something.
Yeah, and I think Kevin's half drunk back then was most people's full drunk. So, which is probably why I just said, huh, interesting, and moved on. But it stuck with me. It was 10 years ago, and it's still the philosophical conundrum being raised in even this conversation right now.
You know, in a weird way, I actually think this relates to China after the Maoist revolution and the communist revolution's success, which was, you know, okay, we've achieved the revolution. Communist society is here. Okay, class struggle still exists, but now it's displaced into this new realm, which is, you know, the bureaucracy and the party and the masses. So, I mean, it's sort of a different context, but it's interesting to think that, you know, again, struggle will continue. After the communist horizon, there's still going to potentially be some sort of struggle in existence. It just will look very different than how we understand it now, perhaps.
Well, sure. Especially, you know, if it's true that a synthesis of the thesis and antithesis contain kind of elements of both, right? And that impregnated within that is the negation of the negation, then we should have to accept that, logically speaking, that that there will be new forms of struggle about old things in a sort of at a higher plane, or, you know, what Lenin described as history moving in spirals rather than in a line, so that, you know, we might like transcend and defeat a set of conditions or whatever and the corresponding set of ideas, but that they reemerge in a higher form. That's yeah. I mean, I think that that's what that conversation about class struggle under socialism is meant to approximate and to drive at.
Word.
You can never tell if you should feel good or bad about sucking all the air out of the room.
Well, I guess what it makes me think about is, you know, in a non-eclectic, like, in an orthodox Marxist view, is there a difficulty with grappling with the idea that there will be some sort of, like, displaced, you know, dialectically transformed struggle? I guess I'm wondering, you know, that, I mean, I think it's a really interesting thing to talk about, and it also strikes me as an important thing to consider whenever I think back to how rare it is that we talk about, okay, like, so what are the actual practical situations and challenges and issues that we're going to have to contend with if, you know, if at some point we get a chance to be a part of something that is, you know, after capitalism in our context? And I think that's one of those questions that I just wonder, like, how many people ever actually sit down and think about that or have to ask themselves, like, what will that look like? I don't know if you all have ever read much Frederick Jameson, but you know, Don, who's on Red Library, him and I have recently read a Jameson essay called An American Utopia. And it's sort of his really interesting, almost like science fiction-esque like description of what a sort of socialist, like post-capitalist society would look like in the U.S. And one of the most, I think, important things he has to say is that, you know, there are going to be some aspects of the institutions that we know now that probably will persist in all, you know, new, different, dialectically transformed ways. But there will also be struggles that exist. It's like socialist revolution isn't going to mean that people aren't going to be assholes to each other. And we're going to have to prepare for that and contend with that. And how are we going to deal with that, you know, with this idea that one day we'll be part of being able to build something new? And I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure if this is sort of resonating with y'all in terms of this particular idea, but I mean, to me it feels like it's one of those questions that we have to ask ourselves pretty seriously.
Yeah.
All right, did I just suck all the air out of the room and now?
Well, if we can't be assholes after the revolution, then I don't want to have anything to do with that shit.
No, I think you're absolutely right about that. Part of my hesitation to immediately jump in with the responses, because I just don't want to derail conversation even further from the text at hand. And I don't immediately off the top of my head have a way to sort of veer back into the text from that.
Well, Kevin, don't you remember that Jacoby says early on that we should put a moratorium on sexual studies?
I don't think he says that.
Well, in a non sequitur, Jason, I wanted to hear if you had an elaboration on, speaking of being on chapter four, an elaboration on Zinoviev and the portion of this chapter where Jacoby is talking about Korsh and Korsh's defense of Lukács as a threat, and being seen as a threat by Zinoviev in that fight in the Comintern, because I know you've got you helped write an article on exactly that, this subject at one.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Just I'm trying to think of what about it would be particularly relevant to where we're trying to go, other than just to say that, like, you know, the sort of, you know, the Trotskyist movement from which we come, and the in the Stalinized, you know, and the legacy of the Comintern after, you know, what we call the kind of the glory years of the first few congresses. In both cases, we sort of are actually like, whether you sort of identify with the Stalin trajectory or the Trotsky trajectory of that moment or of that process, that what we've done is sort of adopted whole hog the legacy of Zinoviev's Comintern, which is a sort of an outward expression of the Soviet Union in isolation and in degeneration and in crisis. And it really is actually like the, more than anything, it's like the personal project of Grigory Zinoviev as like the dictator of the Comintern. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's a sort of an unknown history, but it's really like everybody who calls himself a Trotskyist should also consider whether or not they're actually a Zinovievist. And I'm not really sure if that's super useful other than just, it's of historical interest anyways, but I think it's the case that it's not something that we should instinctively want to reproduce. You know, you know, like it was said earlier, I think Chris, you said it, we talked about the heroic period of the Comintern, but we forget about at the exact same time, it's the pig-headed dictatorial period of the Comintern. It happens to be the same period.
Right. Yeah, that was me.
Yeah, that was you. Right. And right, thinking fourth dimensionally about it. We should seek to transcend trying to live out that legacy.
No, absolutely. Victor Serge's comment about the seed of Stalinism was contained in Lenin's Bolshevik party, but that or the germ of it, I think was what he called it. But that doesn't mean that we should condemn the corpse of the dead man for the germ that it contained at its birth. But rather we should seek to identify these bits for sure and learn from them, but hold dear the parts that can teach us as we move forward, you know?
Right. Yeah. He says that there were a myriad of other germs that could have turned into a multiplicity of other different things that didn't necessarily have to be Stalinism, which is the disease that killed the body in question.
Right. Here's how I think it relates directly back to this book is, the question of organization and whether it's a technical question or something more. And I think the kind of Comintern, Zinoviev / Trotsky, Stalin, whatever legacy is organization as a technical question, right? That this is that there is a model and that there are pieces that you put in place and there are appropriate slogans and appropriate, you know, methods of work and habits, and that's the question of organization. And then, you know, for somebody like Lukács, that actually the party is supposed to be the sort of the repository and representative of consciousness. So that, like, you know, to use Debord's term, it's the difference between alienated and unalienated political form. And, you know, the question is, can the working class take a political form that is dictated to it? And because I think we're thinking properly about this, that it is necessarily bears the imprint of the society that it is grown up in, and can it just like take that ready made and just go into it and use it, like the same way that, you know, you join a church and it already has like, this is how we do the thing in the church. And I think the answer is no, right? The question of organization is much more than a technical question. It's a very deeply, like, you know, a spiritual question in a sense.
Yeah.
In terms of what it does for people's consciousness and subjectivity and whether it does or doesn't equip people to contend with the real world.
Yeah, so this is actually a couple of quotes right from the text. He says, Lukács affirmed, thus the question of organization reveals itself to be an intellectual question. Organization is not a technical question, but is actually the supreme intellectual question of the revolution. And I guess for Lukács, who we actually just did an episode on history and class consciousness, and this comes right from the final essay, but he talks about it as the need to incorporate the whole personality of members into party life as a decisive weapon. And I think that to me is a really kind of radical way to think about this, that, you know, part of what you're trying to counteract, especially in our context now, if we're thinking about that, is we're trying to address the subjective experiences of people, the alienation, isolation, hopelessness, all these sorts of things. ideally, whatever a party would be or whatever organization would be, it wouldn't just be about like technical rote procedures, but it would somehow have an answer to that. And, you know, maybe that is sort of a religious impulse. I'm fine with thinking there is absolutely a religious impulse in all of this. And I think we need to address it as such and use that.
Absolutely.
Right. I think that he refers to the spiritual dependency of the Dutch people on the bourgeoisie as described by, I think, Panikuk. And he said that the idea that there needs to be a sort of class consciousness that is imbued in the lives of those involved in the working class project to counteract that spiritual dependency on the bourgeoisie, and that Lukács sort of picks that up and develops it further, but it exists in the Dutch Marxists as well. I thought that was super interesting, and I really like the whole depiction of what has generally been called, I think, a false consciousness as a sort of spiritual dependency.
It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and I think that really speaks to the American context as well. Because we are absolutely possessed by a spiritual dependency on the bourgeoisie and thoroughly indoctrinated by Horatio Alger myths and the idea that the next entrepreneur that makes it big and comes up with some useless piece of shit product that makes them rich, it's going to be me, you know?
Right. It's what we're struggling with is we're trying to create a workers' movement out of millions of temporarily embarrassed millionaires.
Yes. Who was it? So the United States is a nation of temporarily embarrassed millionaires?
Actually, I think it was John Steinbeck.
Yeah, Steinbeck. Yeah, you're right.
The conversation that we're having about organization, I think that it kind of leads me to a chapter 5 note. So I don't know if this is an inorganic way of getting around to some of these points of discussion. But
yeah, I think go for it.
I think it's Jacobi, and now I don't know how to say the author's name. I think it's a quotation from him. It says that nothing is more scholastic than disputes on the correct line when the proletariat is silenced. So, you know, like when we're talking about like trying to forge a new socialist left in the present conditions, I think that one line actually like really encapsulates what some of our problems are of a lot of these like scholastic debates about the, you know, which Marxist tradition and which school of whatever and what's the right program to have, basically to try to construct the apparatus for a party in embryo absent, you know, the mass movement of the working class, you know, on the move. It really is it should strike us as a warning sign, you know, that if we're talking about the party as being the incorporating the sort of the essence of the of all of its personalities, I don't think you can construct that first and then just fill it with personalities, right? Like the whole point is that structure grows out of the incorporation of the people in it.
You know, maybe this is something that stems from kind of my philosophical background, but one of the things I noticed that is sort of most pervasive and I think is a symptom of this problem that you're talking about is how often you'll be talking with, you know, other leftists and how often they will always say, well, we need to organize the masses, or it's about what the masses want, or the working class. And just to sort of stop and ask, like, why is it that almost the immediate way that we start talking about this is to clearly set up a division between whoever the masses or the working classes are over there and whoever the hell it is that we are? I don't know about y'all, but I mean, I understand that, you know, a lot of groups do spring up out of the university and there's a whole discussion and a whole history about labor aristocracy and intellectuals and petty bourgeoisie and all this other stuff. But like more often than not, I'm like, you know, it's like the people who are around me are all working gig economy jobs or are barely getting by and are living in like tiny one bedroom apartments. It's like, who the fuck are the working classes or the masses that we are somehow separate from? And to me, I think it's a fundamental like it's a problem of identification and knowledge of we already set up this dichotomy out of the gate. And I think it sort of ends up leading to a lot of these other problems in a lot of respects.
Is that spiritual dependency on the bourgeoisie that you were just talking about, Chris?
Yep.
It's like, yeah, well, you know, we all know this, but regular workers don't talk this way or don't read this kind of thing. It's like, well, what kind of workers are you?
Yeah. Also,
I don't consider myself exceptional. I'm fairly regular.
This is how you could tell that I'm about to say something stupid is I saw a tweet that said something like requiring that Marxists read is ableist and classist.
Oh, yeah. Whoa. I saw that tweet. I loved it. I loved it.
Way to tell on yourself, person who's very obviously not of the working class.
Right, exactly.
Workers don't know how to read.
You know, there's this historical anecdote that I remember seeing that tweet, and it reminded me of this, that I think it was maybe like late 1900s, late 19th century, early 20th century. But there's a story about, you know, the working classes, whenever they could, like people who would work on machines, they would hire people to come and read them books on science and philosophy and history while they worked on the machines so they could still learn and be grounded in this sort of theoretical historical knowledge while they were also working. So whenever I hear shit like that, it's just like, who do you think the working classes are? Like, who are the people that you think make up this sort of weird, amorphous, monolithic block in some sort of way? I don't know. To me, that's just one of those things of just like, wow, we got a lot of this shit real wrong right now. We got to work really hard to change how we think about it.
There's this one. There's this one anecdote from the Russian Civil War where the proletarians and, you know, peasantry that had been recruited into the Red Army would be marching. On the march, you would have a commissar on horseback in front of them, like facing backwards, holding up placards with letters on them and teaching them how to sound out the letters as they were marching into battle. So you actually had a political education, it's just a basic education going on at the same time so that these peasants and workers could fully engage with the political project by reading. There is always a faith in the common people that has to exist to any revolutionary. You have to think that the working class is able to understand the things that it is that we're talking about. Even if you don't think that they're going to understand the jargon right off the bat, they're going to be able to understand what we mean in its most basic terms, you know?
Well,
I don't know if that made any sense.
No, it does. I mean, really quick too, I don't know if y'all know this, but we just started our Revolutionary Politics in Central and South America series on Red Library. And you know, that one of the most constant things you see across all these different contexts is a fundamental primary point of organizational sort of focus and struggle was literacy campaigns in Guatemala and Cuba.
Right.
So to me, it's always like, to me, it speaks of a certain kind of, I don't know, like class position or sort of, I don't know, like bubble that you're in where you think that reading and literacy and learning these things have not been fundamental to the development of like revolutionary or even just call them social justice movements, if you want to, throughout time all over the world.
Honestly, I think what we're really talking about is American anti-intellectualism.
Thank you very much for that.
It's definitely a real thing, and people would rather not have to engage in the things that they think are hard, like, there's definitely an anti-intellectual current that imbues the right and the left.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I just want to say that was like shots fired on an untold number of people out there. So I'm glad that we got that put out there.
Yeah, I mean, those are shots very well fired, and they very well deserved.
So I think that, yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's an anti-intellectualism, and it's also a reification, maybe, of certain categories, that it's a sort of safety blanket that allows the person to hold the agent of social change at arm's length to be able to live in a sort of comfort of not having to do anything themselves to actively engage with and change the world. Because so long as the working class is this you know, thing out there that we have to go, like, do everything different to go reach or whatever. It's not this thing where that is, you know, your neighbor or your coworker who you have to engage with and organize.
Right, and I think that's in defiance of actually, like, desired intentions, right? It's a sort of, it's maybe an expression of an unconscious distance, you know, like, oh yeah, of course we want to do this, but it's a matter of not actually knowing the terrain in which you're operating, so you just presume what it is instead. And I think it does betray a kind of a, if not a lived class bias, then an inherited bias from the hegemonic class.
Have y'all ever heard of the dominant ideology hypothesis?
No.
So I was talking to Comrade Jason, who's been on our show a couple of times, about this. I think it was a study that was done, oh, I want to say like maybe late 80s, early 90s, but they were essentially testing the false ideology hypothesis from Marx, that, you know, the ideas of the ruling class are the ones that dominate society and what everyone holds, right? And at least from this study, what they actually found is that the ruling classes, the bourgeois classes, all have very, very strong ideological sort of agreement on a great many issues, on most issues. But once you start getting down into like the lower middle classes, into like the working classes and sort of the lower classes themselves, that what you find is they don't actually have the same ideas as the ruling classes. They actually have a really, really chaotic sort of contradictory mix of all sorts of different ideas and ideologies. And I think that's something too that's really hard to contend with, is that, yeah, I mean, maybe you also have, like, someone could have very progressive, like, very, like, radical views in certain respects, but also have a whole host of other ideas that are deeply conservative or, you know, very anti-intellectual or, you know, all these other things. And these things operate in a way that I think is so core to, like, our identity and, like, our emotional experience that it's sort of like it's hard to know which ones are going to be the ones that are going to be dominant and play out with people until, you know, you maybe start organizing with them together, or you find them like having a really hard situation. So, you know, to me, it's just another thing about how complicated all this is. And like, why is it that people aren't just like out talking to workers and like acting on these ideas that they have? And yeah, I mean, maybe it's like hard and they don't have a lot of experience doing it and there's some development that needs to happen, but maybe it's because, you know, they don't necessarily have a whole set of ideas that lead them to do these certain things all the time. I don't know.
I remember having a discussion with my mom, like it's about 10 years ago, probably, about the idea of organizing society into rule by a system of workers' councils or something like that. And she thought it was a great idea. And, you know, then we sort of veered into, you know, other territory where I brought up, you know, maybe gay marriage and abortion being legal, and she got all the, you know, upset and was completely against it. So my mom, total leftcom, but, you know, was against gay marriage and abortion.
She's kind of a syndicalist then.
Yeah, a little bit.
Well, you know, like that's kind of the essence of that very oft misunderstood Leninism, which is that the, you know, the what we call trade union consciousness, mm-hmm. you know, of like,
yeah,
the sort of the when he's talking about like the kind of if you're only looking at society from the factory floor, the best you can achieve is a trade union consciousness. But what he's talking about is essentially a revolutionary working class socialism, which doesn't take into consideration the sort of questions of structural oppression that affect people who aren't working class or who aren't even just not a part of the shop, which is, you know, the reason why we have all of this discourse about intersectionality or whatever. And I think there's some utility to it because it's meant to broaden your view to the society as a whole. And, you know, that's always misunderstood as being like, oh, Lenin thought, you know, workers were too stupid to be anything other than reformists. And he's saying, like, no, it's actually outside of the questions of philosophy and oppression and all of civil society. Our socialism will only be what we now call, like, workerism or syndicalism. So that's our mom. She's a syndicalist.
I mean, she's way more chill now, but this is a long time ago.
I guess it does speak to you, though, you know, again, one of those complex issues that we have to be willing to engage with, like the actual like consciousness of the people that are around us. And to me, I actually was talking to a good comrade recently about this, that, and I mean, I think this actually is something that Hal Draper once said, which, you know, critique Draper in different respects, but I thought he actually had a pretty good idea with this one, is that, you know, if you want to know what to do and you're not sure, it's like, just start off trying to organize the people around you, talk to them about socialism, like try to figure out what they think. And I mean, at the end of the day, it's like, I don't know, that's not, hopefully we're all doing that to some degree. And I think very quickly you realize, oh shit, this is really complicated. And, you know, it's something that to not retreat from, but hopefully to sort of rise to the occasion.
Absolutely. I hope so.
I hope so. Yeah. Maybe that's a better way to say it. Yeah. Well, just to kind of bring us in. So the first couple of notes I have are Jack, I'm going to call him Jacoby. Because I'm going to just identify, that's my strain in our party split here, is I'm going to be part of the Jacoby and not the Jacoby camp. Sorry, Chris.
Oh man, I don't know how to say it.
So he starts off by talking about the Italian Marxist divide between Antonio Gramsci, who I think we both have talked about a bit on our shows, and Bordiga, and like focusing on, I guess, like Bordiga's. His opposition of workers' councils, but from a like hyper-Leninist position. And I was curious if y'all, like, if you had anything about that particular relationship between Gramsci and Bordiga, and sort of like where to go from that, maybe into talking even about like the Frankfurt School a little bit.
There's this notion of Soviets as the true index of proletarian revolution that I think I instinctively agree with. That's also Lukács, right? And it's also the position that C.L.R. James and Raya Dunayevskaya take. Mm-hmm.
In our former organization.
Yeah. And I think that there's, you know, that it's sort of like a metric in the development of working class subjectivity in a society which is ostensibly building socialism, is the degree to which, you know, workers have means of controlling their environment. And that, you know, the Soviet, the Workers' Council is to date our best idea about how to go ahead and formalize that. I have to admit an incredible unfamiliarity with Bordiga, so that even reading that sort of opposition to workers' councils, like that's an interesting thing that I now know, but I don't really know if I could explain why.
I mean, I think I have to also, you know, say the same for me too. I mean, I've read like bits and pieces of Bordiga here and there, and I've read particular essays and such, but I don't feel like I have a comprehensive enough knowledge to, you know, be able to hash out this particular debate. You know, I feel like I've actually been learning a lot from Alpha to Omega's Revolutionary Strategy series on the Mike McNair book to get a lot of these arguments down myself. So, you know, I mean, I don't know. Maybe we can just let them do that job and move on, unless y'all have some more insight than maybe what I have.
What I know about Bordiga is just a very base knowledge. And he definitely believed that the party was the proletariat, right? The party was the brain that told the muscles and the rest of the body what to do, and that the entire working class should be subject to the dictatorship of the party. He wasn't into the whole radical democracy aspect of Marxism. I think that I mentioned once in a previous episode that we did, where we talked about how the working class isn't the proletariat realizing its world historic mission unless it has a party at its head. Mm-hmm. So that essentially the working class is just an unorganized mass that doesn't necessarily contain that potential until it's organized into and has an or and it is organized and led by the Marxist party. It's all new to me. I always dismiss Bordiga.
Well, I think for Jacoby too, it seems like his discussion of Bordiga isn't necessarily to explicate everything that Bordiga is holding positions on, but just to say that there is some sort of linkage between him and Gramsci, even though they were seen as sort of adversaries in some way. And it's precisely because they both had the view that the Russian model of revolutionary socialism did not have a universal applicability to Western Europe or to Italy or whatever it might be.
Right.
So, I mean, maybe, you know, that's just sort of what we can say, at least, is that, yeah, like they both shared this idea that this sort of idea of a universal model was very much grounded in this sort of Soviet orthodox Marxist idea. And that's precisely what the unorthodox position critiques, is that it doesn't have the same sort of universal applicability based on this sort of idea of like science and the science of revolution and such.
I'm prepared to accept that.
I'm giving that a big thumbs up.
Any nays? Any abstentions?
I'll abstain from this vote.
Duly noted. Duly noted. It'll be marked down in our meeting notes. So, well, I feel like we're kind of trending towards the Frankfurt School discussion, which is something I think we're probably all raring for. Do y'all want to move into that since we've dispensed with the Bordiga Gramsci Twitter feud, whatever you want to call it?
I'm down. Let's go.
Yeah.
So I have a note here that he talks about the Frankfurt School, and you know, I didn't get to mention this at first, but I also see like Jacobi writing this book as a response to Perry Anderson's Considerations on Western Marxism. And I was going back and looking at like what is Anderson's thesis in that book? Like, what exactly is Jacobi sort of responding to in that? And Anderson's general idea is that a lot of the Western Marxist thinkers, philosophers, you know, political figures, he sees them as sort of a kind of losing their way from scientific socialism. So this sort of interest in, you know, media and culture, in all these different things that the Frankfurt School, you know, focused on and really brilliantly sort of explicated, I guess like Anderson saw those as somehow like losing their way from what Marxism really was. But Jacobi has this line where he says that the Frankfurt School, I guess the idea is to see them as sort of being in a flight from politics due to like their bourgeois background and being part of the university and the academy. But, you know, just coming back to material conditions, he says that, you know, they were actually flying from something pretty serious, namely, you know, the fucking Nazi regime at the time. And so, you know, yeah, mainly just understanding like this isn't something that you can explain away by, you know, just looking at their ideas or the fact that they were involved in the university of some kind. So to me, I thought that was sort of a really important thing and, you know, a way to sort of counteract some of these narratives that I hear today about why we shouldn't bother reading like Horkheimer or Adorno as much as, you know, maybe we should.
Right. Well, my knee-jerk response to that is like, I guess, are we meant to only read the philosophical treatises of people who died in the resistance instead? Because who are we reading?
Right. I mean, the idea that that Adorno and Horkheimer are canceled, so we can't read any of their stuff and get anything from it is one that I would have to say is fucking stupid.
Adam, you like led off this next chapter with like a really thoughtful question, and then I gave a kind of pithy answer and then left.
I don't even remember what it was. What were we talking about?
Yeah, I was like, what was the question? Would someone remind me, please?
You were talking about the right. It was about the supposed detachment of, you know, the Frankfurt School as a group of individuals, and by extension, all of Western Marxism from the class struggle, from the real day to day. Duking it out in the streets that I guess we sort of imagine that all class struggle is. Whether that's valid, and B, what that says about what we can learn from the stuff that they were doing.
Well, it's funny that I think if, let's say, hypothetically, you jettison the Frankfurt School and their sort of influence, right? Whenever I think about it, I'm like, okay, what do you lose? You lose a general critique of the consumer society and the role that culture has played in capital and its commodification. I think you lose a general sort of understanding of like messianic religious impulses and Marxism and the role that that plays, a la Benjamin. You lose this critique of instrumental reason. You lose a critique of like what exactly led to Auschwitz and you know, and the concentration camps, like precisely through a kind of elevation of scientific reason. I mean, and that's what like baffles me about it, is because it's like these are all like problems that we are actively still discussing and debating right now. So I'm not, it just blows me away to be like, why would you get rid, or like what is the point of getting rid of some of the most powerful critiques of these things? Like, what, you're only weakening your own understanding of your own material context by doing this.
Absolutely. So. Maybe this is just like we're looking at the continuation of the very thing that Jacobi is sort of critiquing in this book, which is the need of the common turn to defeat dissenting voices by just sort of snuffing them out rather than engaging with them and disagreeing if you see fit or whatever. But you don't even have to necessarily think that any of the members of the Frankfurt School were right about anything that they ever wrote to say that it's worthwhile to engage with these very, very serious and elaborate contemplations of issues that we're still facing today, you know? And in no small part, I think, not the least of which is their own sort of living in the shock of the absolute and horrifying defeat of utopian, you know, yearnings.
Yeah, actually, on that note, and just to bring us back to the book, y'all mind if I read another quote here about the Frankfurt School?
Do it.
So Jacobi says, "To Orthodox Marxists, the Frankfurt School remained a scandal. It never severed its link to German idealism and historicism. It criticized the fetish of science. It stayed clear of proletarian organizations. It was too interested in culture, psychoanalysis, and subjectivity. And most damning of all, it lacked successes, but not pessimism. Yet pessimism is not only a personal choice or quirk. It is drenched in a heartless past. A cheerful Marxism is already suspect. It whitewashes the past in the name of a red future. What must be recognized is that the Western Marxist and the Frankfurt School, the desperate hope of the dialectic had not been realized, nor could the pain and suffering of the past simply be added to the bill of the bourgeoisie. Marxists were implicated and sometimes responsible. The shadow that accompanies Marxism is cast by this reality." So for me, that was probably the best passage I found about sort of this impulse to jettison them even today, and sort of how it's very much an Orthodox Marxist impulse to do so.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I like that. I actually wrote that down as well. It was a pertinent quote that I thought sort of, if it brings it back around to a revolutionary pessimism.
Well, would y'all want to maybe just to end out chapter 5, talk a little bit about the comparison between the Hotel Abyss and the Hotel Lux that we, I guess, talked
indeed,
a little bit
exactly.
about off air?
Yeah, exactly. Let's do it.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts of the book. I actually took screenshots. I took photos and then sent them to a couple of different groups of friends because I thought it was just like really powerful. It's probably a lot to read out loud, though.
No, go for it. It's a good passage. Read
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
Jacobi says that late in Lukács' long career, he denounced Adorno and other Marxist intellectuals for their pessimism and distance from revolutionary organizations. He charged that they preferred to remain in what he called the Grand Hotel Abyss, a beautiful hotel where one could contemplate the void in first-class comfort. The designation has enjoyed a certain vogue. It inferred that Marxist intellectuals, without a party of the proletariat, lacked verve and commitment. If Lukács allowed this denunciation, others who enthusiastically repeat it should not forget the few choices and options of the time. The risks were not only of falling in the front lines, but of liquidation in the back rooms. While Lukács survived in Moscow in the 1930s and 40s, others were less fortunate. Even Béla Kun, Lukács' bitter opponent in the Hungarian party, was arrested in 1938. To denounce the refugees in the Hotel Abyss without recognizing that the hotels on the street of Marxism were not only far apart, but often fire traps, is to mislead the traveler. Any guide that is more than a public relations ploy must scrutinize and evaluate all of the available accommodations. If the Hotel Abyss can symbolize Western Marxism in the 1930s and 40s, the Hotel Lux can symbolize Soviet Marxism. Unlike the Hotel Abyss, the Lux was not a metaphor, but a hotel housing foreign communists who resided in Moscow. A detailed guidebook might mention that the Lux offered special service. Visitors were often spared the annoyance of checking out. Many foreign communists were arrested in their rooms in the Lux. The guide also might include individuals' accounts of the accommodations. Heinz
Neumann.
Heinz Neumann, the sharp critic of Korsch and Maslow and of the reliable servant of the Comintern, stayed at the Lux until arrested there in 1937. His wife recalled that at the end of their search of their room, Naumann told her, "Don't cry." The secret police leader then ordered, "That's enough, get a move on now." At the door, she remembered Heinz turned and strode back, took me in his arms again and kissed me. "Cry then," he said. "There's enough to cry about." Naumann never returned. Along with the other German communists, in one of the infamous deals of history, his wife was delivered by the Russians to the Nazis during the Nazi-Soviet Pact. So a way to sum that up is you can criticize the Frankfurt School for being sort of detached and apart from, you know, Communist Party life in this period, but they also weren't, you know, loose the mortal coil like so many intellectuals who did go into party life.
Yeah, I would maybe venture to say that is my favorite passage for the entire book.
Yeah, mine too.
It's simultaneously like one of my favorite and least favorite.
That's very dialectical. Say more.
No, I mean
too dialectical. What do you mean?
No, I mean I think it's very potent, but at the same time, it just really bums me the fuck out.
Oh yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah, I think that very much so is something that we can keep in our heads moving forward. Our podcast, and I'm sure yours has, I've seen it criticized in several other places as being something like that at the Grand Hotel Abyss. Like, you know, these sound like a bunch of disaffected former Trotskyists who have no connection to the movements on the ground, which is, first of all, not true, and second, like, it's just like, yeah, so,
and second is
it's,
true.
It is both not and is true, but like, it's being able to critique everything, and regardless of whether or not you're immediately a part of it, is something that I think that we all need to be able to do. You know, I mean, I think that our standpoint, where we come from, doesn't have as much of a bearing on what we are able to critique as we think it does, you know?
You know, what's funny is when we were first kicking around the idea of doing a podcast where we explore previously heretical ideas and, you know, try to come up with some new ones and read a lot of stuff together, that one of the early suggestions was Grand Radio Abyss.
I mean, that's our Twitter handle.
Yeah. And that was, you know, we ended up using it as the Twitter name, but it was sort of tongue in cheek, sort of self reflection on my, I don't know if this is true for everybody, but for me, it's my own notion that to be a socialist means you have to be a part of an organization. So I always have been since I was, since I was 17, and I no longer think that. And part of the reason why I no longer think that is because I've been in enough environments which actually kind of discourage the kind of exploration that I think is necessary, that I think I'm more comfortable now with the idea that it's not the case that there's always something that can be done organizationally, right? Because again, you know, referring back to the text, organization is not a merely technical question. And, you know, maybe the tasks before us, you know, at some points look more like, you know, the tasks before us, you know, in the period when the Frankfurt School was, you know, coming together. That, you know, it's like, or to put it a different way, let me put it like this. After 1848, Marx and Engels, they didn't try to maintain the Communist League and, you know, develop a special Communist League kind of canon and tradition to be handed down from generation to generation. You know, they actually dissolved it, and then they went to the library, because it's not always the case that the revolution's right around the corner. And that's part of the value of this book, is in spelling that out in much more complex terms to give you really something to think through.
I think for me too, and I'm glad that we're sort of reading this particular passage, and the thing that is occurring to me is how often, maybe whenever we're evaluating this history that we're a part of, and, you know, whenever I hear that y'all are criticized as a bunch of, you know, like disaffected, like Trotskyist, my response is like, and, you know, like, so what? Like,
right.
Yeah. And I guess like my thought is how often, you know, maybe we look back at this history and the complexity of the relationship to it is kind of built on this idea that, you know, we call this in therapy, sometimes we call it the just world hypothesis, that there's some idea that we carry with us from very young, which is, you know, good things happen to good people, like the world is a just place, it makes sense. And it's deeply tied to this idea of some sort of higher power that we are, you know, trusting to make sense of everything and to give us answers and to structure our life in a particular way. But, you know, more and more you sort of realize is that that idea is precisely the thing that causes us harm and trauma and keeps us stuck in the past. And, you know, the way that you sort of engage with this is that you kind of learn how to change that idea and say, you know what, like, the world is not a just place. It's not necessarily an unjust place. It's not these sort of like absolute categories. It's like, you know, there are people who do horrible things to each other, and there are people who somehow find a way to like change history and to, you know, be these sort of figures of revolutionary change and, you know, whatever it might be. And maybe that's, for me, like reading this book, it kind of makes me step back and start to rethink a lot of things and say, you know what? Yeah, it isn't necessarily like gods that have failed. It really was just like men and women struggling for power in really unknown circumstances that were unique, and no one had any idea how to deal with them. I mean, reading about the German Revolution, which we're going to do an episode on soon, that's the thing I take away from that, is that they had no idea what the hell they were doing, and they were struggling. I'm making guesses, and there was a lot of contingency and chance. And we're in the same exact position. You know, we can't rely on the gods to save us. Even the gods of Marx and Engels and, you know, past historical movements. It's like, it's just us, you know? We got to figure out what the hell to do, you know?
Right.
There is no great other. There is only us.
So, you know, if we're all a bunch of disaffected Marxists of various strands, you know, it's like, okay, well, I mean, that's what we got to work with. And, you know, so where do we go from here?
Yeah, here we are. Exactly.
Hello, Chris here. Just dropping in to remind everyone that we have a Patreon account. Right now, we've only got one tier, and it is set at $2. So if you are interested in helping out the show and you would like to get access to our exclusive content, which we've actually been posting lately, just go ahead and sign up on our only tier for $2. You can feel free to donate as much as you want, but as for now, you'll only get rewards for the $2. Eventually, we might add more tiers in and put really cool stuff, but we don't really have the time to do that right now. So, head on over to Patreon and join for $2. Also, don't forget to add us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and to tell your friends about us. Okay, thanks a lot. Back to the show.
Circle back around to point that I raised at the very, very beginning, where where Jacoby talks about a discussion of the labor aristocracy as a theory of reformism.
Oh yeah. That's a good one.
So he talks about this as a flat economism, where it reduces the existence of reformism to its structural determinants and eliminates entirely out of it the subjective experience of those participants of that political trajectory. So the attraction of it, I think he notes, is exactly the he talks about specifically the who is it that he discusses, somebody who did a phenomenological analysis, a heretical to the orthodox Marxist. Mitchell wrote a book that was heretical to the orthodox Marxist, that was an analysis of reformism that that Jacoby renders as a phenomenological analysis. It puts the reader, puts the author, puts you into the shoes of the person who is being analyzed, and lets you see the world from their point of view. And I think that is a lot of what he's trying to do in this whole book. I think this is a primary lesson that he takes from Marcuse, is that he's trying to recapture a revolutionary subjectivity, mm-hmm. by inflating the flat reduction or a flat economism of orthodox Marxism with a real lived internal life, the necessity of having to grapple with particular experiences that are distinct from not distinct from, but that are just so much more deep and more complex than a flat structural analysis would allow you to understand or conceive of. And it gives rise to totally different possibilities. That, I think, is a really interesting project, one that I am definitely very interested in sort of exploring more. And it's not one that I think that I entirely perfectly have a perfect grasp on at this point. But I think it's really interesting and compelling.
He says that the theory of the labor aristocracy implies that the theory of immiseration is the correct one, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that, like, if there the existence of a labor aristocracy as the reason that there is not a correct class consciousness and there is no revolutionary potential, if that is correct, it means that the theory of immiseration is correct, which means that necessarily the more downtrodden and exploited and oppressed that a working class is, the more revolutionary potential it has, which is objectively incorrect, right? We've seen over and over again that there's not a one-to-one correlation between oppression and exploitation and revolutionary potential. I really liked that he sort of like eviscerates both of those theories. The labor aristocracy and the immiseration theories are just economistic and scientistic. And it's one of the things that the Western Marxism sets itself up against is...
I think what's so important about this too is how if on some level you subscribe to these orthodox Marxist theories, the theory of immiseration or the labor aristocracy, whenever you're confronted with, you know, what in Lacanian psychoanalysis we'd call the real of actually talking to working class people, whenever you encounter that they're so much more complex than what these theories lead you to believe, mm-hmm. it causes such, I think, a shattering of like your coordinates that either you dismiss them as sort of like anomalies, like, oh, they just don't fit into the theory for some reason. Or I think it leads to a really intense feeling of defeat and, you know, not like pessimism that's productive in any sort of way. And I'm wondering if you all have like felt this too, that it's precisely whenever you subscribe to these theories and then realize that the context, the material conditions of people and the time that you find yourself in don't fit and these things don't adequately explain what you're dealing with, it very easily leads to that feeling of powerlessness and hopelessness because the whole theory that you're operating on has been proven untrue, like through direct personal experience.
And we would always explain it away by saying, well, this is a relatively low period of struggle. In heightened periods of struggle, the working class consciousness can change on a dime.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't be, you shouldn't feel as though that the theory that you ascribe to is wrong. Which, I mean, there is a bit of truth in that. But it's also true that it's much more complicated and interesting than that.
Yeah. And also, I think it depends on how you define what labor aristocracy is now. Is it the exact same as whenever Lenin defined it? Because as far as I'm concerned, you know, most people don't have that sort of nuance when they use it. You know, it is very much like, no. Oh, well, Lenin said this, so this is obviously like what is happening now, without any understanding of, you know, that was 100 years ago. Like, things have changed a little bit in terms of capitalist class relations.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I think you can make an appeal to a sort of a first world privilege, right, that functions in a similar manner as racial categories do. It, like, you sort of divide sections of the working class, give special benefits to one section of it, and in order to keep them both immiserated. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the more beneficial class is actually benefiting from this divide and conquer situation, but it's but it does point to a real material reality that the more privileged section is being sort of bought into their own oppression. I think that that's a useful way of looking at, you know, first world workers versus third world workers and first world nationalism, this sort of thing.
Oh, but, yeah, sure.
but exactly, I do think that, you know, but on the other side of that, I think that Jacoby is correct to say that there's not, you know, a one-to-one determinant in any given situation.
For example, dock workers in the United States and in, you know, the whole of, like, the global north are among the most well-paid and well-organized workers that there are. And they're also, you know, when you read stories about, like, real class mobilization on the BDS front, or like, the think about the relationship between the ports and, like, you know, Occupy Oakland or whatever, mm-hmm. or a whole number of instances in which the militancy that earned dock workers such a, you know, a better position relative to even other sections of organized sections of the working class in this country, it also seems to translate in a lot of ways to more than bread and butter struggles. And that's the case time and time again. Which is just to say, I think that, like, just to round out how complex it can be, you could look at dock workers, members of the ILWU on the West Coast in this country, and you could see there's the labor aristocracy. They're better paid than whoever and whatever.
Than me, for fucking sure.
Right, they're definitely better paid than I am. But on the other hand, you see that potential for what, you know, what we call class consciousness at a higher and higher stage, more on display there overall over the last, you know, number of years than in a lot of places where immiseration is a much more established fact. That's just to say that, like, I actually don't know if the aristocracy of labor is a particularly useful category.
And at least if it's not, let's have a discussion about it at the very least.
Right.
And try to at least understand, yeah, okay, is this category, you know, still applicable, and is it still useful for us to deploy in a way that's strategic and helps us understand the material relations that we find ourselves in. You know, on this note, would y'all mind if I give you my last quote that I had that I think kind of ties some of this together as well? Would that be cool?
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think that feels like a pretty natural place to do that. Okay.
So this is the very last thing I have taken directly from the book. So Jacoby says, if tomorrow the economic order disintegrates, the revolutionary class may rally to the reaction. The myth that the proletariat is simply biding its time, that despite all appearances it is revolutionary in heart and mind, has drugged Marxists for far too long. The mystique of success generates the fiction of defeat. Setbacks and losses are chalked off as unreal or momentary. The absence of class consciousness is a ploy, an illusion of bourgeois commentators, or the excuse of rootless intellectuals, or it is ascribed to a combination of factors that cannot endure. The orthodoxy is preserved by belittling the phenomenon, deferring to the myth of a steadily growing class-conscious proletariat.
For wars, a blade draws blood, but often tarnishes.
La 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 la.
Through blazing eyes, I see new sunsets, sky now breaking, different shades of red.
La 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 la.
You beg for plagues of blazing locusts, call for wars to wet the earth. Cover the world in black and bracken, flaming stubble, with church bell battles.
La 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 la.
And then I lie in the arms of a smiling girl who prays to Christ and the pale queens. Mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow. Where did I stand before I touched the shadows of this life to touch the dark? Then dream of ice, an endless winter in this dog day age. I kiss the cross, but dream of wars. Back bagatelle for a massacre. The walls of fire were built to last. But old men die and stone will turn to stone. And then I kiss the lips of a smiling girl who calls on Christ. And the pale queens, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow. Immaculate heart of immaculate love of tawdry scarecrow for a tarnished crown. La, 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 la. His five wounds bleed, but only on his throne his toothless smile cuts wide across his face. And then I lie in the arms of a smiling girl who prays to Christ. And the pale queens, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow. And what shall I receive a little drum to beat when I march with scorched earth steps? A rocking horse for the little warrior to trample around and down fields of rape. Alabaster doll for the little maid while she waxes and wanes through the blood of the moon, and camouflage smocks for the purest of pure, a mask and a mark and a flag of their shame. And I'll die in the arms of a smiling girl who prays to Christ. And the pale queens, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow. And where shall I go, back there and back, furthest and far, to the edge of the shore? Snow falls thick, its mantle of strength descends with the winter on those in its service. The snow is the winner. Message of winter, your hope shall be crushed. The light flame grows dimmer. Child's laughter ceases on a front with no ending, within words with no meaning. Child's laughter sickens. Child's fever rages, smoldering pages, Inquisition. And I lie in the arms of a smiling girl who calls on Christ. And the pale queens, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow. Mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow, mighty in sorrow.